I'm Roger Baker, Executive Director of the Stratfor Center for Applied Geopolitics at RAIN, a global center of excellence for geopolitical intelligence and analysis. Learn how you can put geopolitics to work for your organization at rainnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Beyond COVID podcast from RAIN Network. In this podcast series, David Lawrence, co-founder of RAIN, speaks with Dr. Fred Southwick, an infectious disease specialist at the University of Florida's College of Medicine, and Dr. Bill Lang, an expert in public health responses to biological incidents, about the current state of the COVID-19 pandemic. Let's listen in on this week's conversation.
Fred and Bill, once again, thanks for spending some time. Obviously, we're no longer reporting on a weekly basis, so it's been a few weeks. Coincidentally, the CDC just came out with some new guidance because COVID is still going around, and maybe you can take a few minutes to explain the guidance and sort of the advice that you are in turn giving to your patients. Fred, do you want to start, and then over to Bill?
Sure. I am aware they just came out today. One of the problems is, the good news is that in general, there are very few patients being hospitalized for COVID, and that even though a fair number of people are getting it, it seems more like the other coronaviruses in that it's relatively a mildly severe upper respiratory infection without any significant hypoxia or serious clinical problems. So the question comes up, should these patients all be quarantined for prolonged periods of time now? What about work? And the CDC has become more realistic as the severity of the disease has gone down, and now is recommending 5 days after the onset of symptoms, if you're asymptomatic, that you can return to work wearing a M95 type of mask. I think this is reasonable. The concern I have is that, in my experience, the antigen stays positive for much more than 5 days after symptoms end. In fact, I personally had a nasal swab that was positive for 12 days. And so I think it might be considered supplementing this with nasal antigens. But Bill will have some ideas on this.
Yeah, my thought has been, as Fred said, this is acting much more like so many other routine viruses that are out there, including the other four coronaviruses. This has become the coronavirus number five. People may remember that we talked about that of the other four coronaviruses, there was an outbreak that was very, very similar to what we had with COVID, a coronavirus that killed a lot of people quickly, or a virus that was too early to know whether it was a coronavirus back in the 1880s. And it did the same thing. It lasted about two seasons, killed a lot of people. Then it was still around. They were able to determine that the virus was still around, but it just kind of blended into the background and it became just another coronavirus. So now we have these five coronaviruses. And what the CDC is saying is they've actually gone even beyond the saying that you can go out after 5 days. They're saying that if your symptoms are mild and you don't have a fever, or it's been more than 24 hours since your last fever, you're free to go. And part of the reasoning is that it hasn't been affecting people significantly, that most people aren't testing anyway, and that even the people who do test, they aren't bothering to stay out 5 days. So why give a recommendation that nobody's following anyway? What I'm telling patients that I work with, however, is that if you're around somebody who is at risk, you know, such as I've got a 90-something-year-old father, if I have COVID, I'm not going to go around my 90-year-old father a day after I have a fever. So I think it's important to be a little bit circumspect about the, you know, free and clear message that they're sending. But the bottom line is you treat this like you'd treat any other moderately severe viral illness, I wouldn't go around my dad if I have just a bad cold. Well, I'm not going to go around him if I've got COVID either. So that's the way to think of it. It's just like, it's basically just like any other bad respiratory virus at this point.
So first of all, I think that's an important point. And I'd say, Fred, because you and Bill have always inserted a great deal of common sense, I'll call it common courtesy, to your protocols. So can you talk a little bit, because I think we're seeing less data around COVID these days, and whether that's because of the reduced hospital rates or, but they're, you know, it's clearly still going around. Maybe you can comment on the state of the record and state of data.
Well, in terms of data in regards to COVID, there essentially isn't any. The best data that we've had for really the past year or so has been sewage studies, but even the sewage studies are not finding that they're corresponding significantly to clinically significant outbreaks anymore. So it's even those studies aren't good. So what is I find is actually more helpful is following the influenza-like illnesses. That is a report that's available. It's FluView is what looks at influenza-like illness reports around the country. And what we are seeing in FluView is that we have, in fact, peaked out, rates of flu are in fact decreasing, of flu-like illnesses, which would include COVID, are decreasing both clinically, and then flu itself is decreasing in laboratory studies. So we seem to be through flu season. The one caveat is that some years there is a rebound in late March, early April. It's not uncommon to see that rebound, but we're not seeing anything yet. Things peaked this year right around the first of the year, which is a little bit earlier than usual, and it's been pretty flat ever since.
No, I agree with Bill. It's in our hospital now, it's just faded in the background. It's just another virus. So I think that's why nobody's following it very closely anymore, because the severity of the illness is relatively mild, and it's usually incidental finding. In our cases, I was just on the wards last week, and we had a couple that had turned positive, but we just wore masks, and there really wasn't any big concern. The one area that I did find that the COVID did have an impact, we had a patient with Alzheimer's disease who suddenly got much, much worse, and there was a vague history of fever. But it turned out that the reason the patient suddenly got more confused and disoriented was he got COVID. And when we did the respiratory panel, we found that out. We treated him with remdesivir, but after about 3 or 4 days, he was back to his normal self.
Okay, and just we went to the flu. National news was filled with reports of this very contagious norovirus that is going around. Certainly we're getting it here in the Northeast, and I have clients in the Southwest who are also experiencing it. Do you have any insights about that and the types of precautions people should be taking, and if they do get it, what they should be doing?
Norovirus has been around forever. There's nothing about norovirus that's really changing. It is incredibly infectious for people who are in close quarters. So that includes living facilities where people are together a lot, such as nursing homes or even daycares, or where it's most famous for, of course, is on ships. It is the only way to put it is what it is. It's a fecal-oral transmitted disease. So it gets transmitted because people are having illness and not washing their hands well enough. There is some thought that it may be slightly airborne, not airborne as in you cough it out, but airborne because when you have bad diarrhea, it can, when the toilets flush, it can create a cloud of these little tiny viral particles, but it's mostly, it's hand-borne. So it's incredibly important that if you're around someone with any kind of GI, especially diarrheal disease, make sure they're washing your hands, you wash your hands, use hand sanitizer, especially before you eat. But this happens every year. We are seeing an increased rate of it right now in large parts of the country. But it's, other than taking good care with your hand hygiene, especially if you're sick, I never want to say a disease is not dangerous, because people who are otherwise ill can have big problems with it, but it's not a major thing to be concerned about.
Yeah, I agree with Bill. The big problem with this organism is that chlorine works reasonably well, but not it's not as sensitive to chlorine as some other agents. So it can be on high concentrations on surfaces, and I think it can last several days and still be virulent. So that's the problem. It's really hygiene, surface cleaning, unlike the coronavirus, where COVID-19 cleaning surfaces was not a fomites and contaminated surfaces was not a problem. When it comes to norovirus, that is the major mechanism for spread. And on cruise ships, it was the smorgasbord, you know, everybody going to a common source, picking up foods, and spreading the virus through the foods is a major, major problem in that group.
And the utensils were the right. Those are the big vectors. So yeah, at this time of year, if you're in an area that has a norovirus outbreak, you might want to think twice before going to a salad bar or that type of serving setting.
Right.
Yeah, Billy, one other thing in reading, David. The other thing,
go ahead.
David just sent us a little article from the Northeast. Apparently, this is a hypervirulent form, which really is giving very fulminant nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. So the problem you get into, really, with young children and with the elderly, is dehydration. So I think the better part of valor is if you get this and you're at all debilitated or a young child, you want to make sure you see the physician early for the possibility you may require intravenous hydration.
I think the standard protocols, at least the ones I saw out of the Mayo Clinic and Hopkins and such, is obviously the, as you say, Fred, the risk of dehydration. So continuing to take in water, small sips multiple times, ice chips. But also, as you said, with kids, very important to consult a physician early because of the risks, particularly to children. Fred, I know you're, I think, in Florida, the issue of measles is coming back. And maybe you could take a minute or two to talk about that disease and what's happening in Florida and what, you know, the best advice you have. We have a number of clients who've actually raised this question. You know, they're based in Florida, so they've asked if we could address it. Anything you would like to share with the audience?
Well, measles is more infectious than SARS-CoV-2 by an order or two of magnitude. If you're in a room with somebody that has measles, it's after very short exposures, you are at risk of developing it. So vaccination is critical in preventing this disease and keeping people who have it from coming into a closed environment, because those people, anybody that's not vaccinated, will become sick. So unfortunately, Florida has become the anti-vax state, thanks to our Surgeon General, who is denigrating all vaccines. And in fact, he's not emphasizing the measles vaccine. He certainly has been actually scaring people about the mRNA COVID-19 vaccines. And so I think this on top of, and I think a fair number of children, particularly in certain religious groups, are anti-vax, and those are the children that come in and spread it for those that are unvaccinated. Fortunately, the area where this has happened, the vaccination rate is over 95% among children. So it has not had a big impact. And last time I read, there were like 10 to 15 cases. Bill may know better. But it hasn't been an impact. But it's a particularly dangerous situation, and emphasize the importance of school vaccination.
So the one other thing, I do a lot of travel medicine, and so something I'm always telling people with travel medicine, because overseas flu has, there's always flu, measles popping up overseas. If you were born before the early 90s, and it varied by state, but it's basically the early 90s, you only got one vaccine. You got MMR, measles, mumps, rubella vaccine was done at roughly 15, 18 months of age, and that was it. It was only in the early 90s that a second MMR was included. What they found was that over a period of about 10 to 15 years, with a single MMR dose, immunity drops. So it's believed to be important to have at some point in your life a second MMR. So anyone who is older than about 34, 35 years of age should check and see. And if in doubt, then it's not a bad idea to get a second MMR vaccine. The second one is good for life, but you need two.
Okay, once again, some great advice. And, Fred, one thing I will say, measles is not necessarily top of mind, but because of the efficacy of the vaccines, and I assume, Bill, both you and Fred remain in alignment around the general efficacy of the vaccines that are being prescribed, including obviously the COVID vaccines. So I just always like to circle back to that question.
Absolutely. It's very interesting. It turns out that the new I was just reading yesterday, the new RSV vaccine is very safe. However, there have been a few cases of Guillain-Barré, and Guillain-Barré has not been seen with the mRNA vaccines. And apparently, one of the companies is going to create an RSV vaccine using mRNA, which will prevent that very serious complication. Even though it's rare, we'd like that never to happen. So I think that further supports the safety of mRNA vaccines and how what a step forward they really represent.
Bill, I assume you concur with that as well.
I do concur with the safety. Yeah. I'm still not pushing hard on being an annual up-to-date vaccine. This, without question, the CDC recommendation is that everybody should be up-to-date with the bivalent vaccine. That is the recommendation. I feel like everyone should have a complete series plus one booster. And the disease has become so prevalent in the United States that essentially everybody, when they look at prevalence studies, essentially everybody has been exposed. I don't know if that the additional boosters are adding that much at the margin, except for people who are at high risk. I talked about my father before. I've encouraged him to get a booster and stay boosted. But for young, healthy adults, I'm not as convinced.
I agree with that, Bill. It should be pointed out the CDC just recommended that for this spring, those over age 65 should get another booster for COVID-19. And I think certainly in those that have any underlying disease, that's a good idea.
Yeah, I agree, because I think that even though the mRNA vaccine is a very exceedingly low-risk vaccine, there is some risk to it. For a young, healthy person, there is incredibly low risk to getting the disease at this point. So we're not saying that there's a risk to the, I'm not saying that there's a risk to the vaccine, so you shouldn't get it. I'm saying it's like anything else. You have to look at the competing risks. And right now, for young, healthy adults, the risk of acquiring and having a bad outcome with COVID is really exceedingly low. And I think, in my opinion, and it's just my opinion, CDC does not share my opinion on this, that I think the vaccine risk is comparable, if not a little bit higher. But the data on it is unclear.
All right. I want to, just in closing, switch gears to a topic that a lot of our audience have raised with me in some of their emails, which is, what are we doing to monitor the landscape to make sure that if there is a potential epidemic or some serious health risk, we'll actually be able to know about it sooner, and we'll be able to hopefully have a non-political and very medical and scientific response to it. What are we doing, and how are we sort of incorporating maybe some of the lessons from the pandemic?
So a national treasure that is what is typically underfunded, but they still do an incredible job, is the Epidemiologic Investigation Service of CDC. The EIS is a very good organization. They have people, U.S. Public Health Service officers, stationed domestically and around the world. They are constantly scanning the whole world for evidence of infectious outbreaks. They are even more than the World Health Organization, the CDC's Epidemiologic Investigation Service is the world's front line against the outbreak of infectious disease. So unfortunately, it's like anything else. They get funded well when there's an outbreak, and then as time goes on, their funding goes down and down and down until we have another outbreak, and then they get well funded again. Fortunately, right now, they are still well funded because we're just coming out of COVID. But it would behoove everybody to keep asking your decision makers on these kinds of things, your elected representatives, are we continuing to fund the CDC Epidemiologic Investigation Service?
Yeah, David, I obviously agree with Bill completely. And I think it really is important that we continually fund these organizations, because as we found out with COVID-19, the earlier we understand the threat, the more quickly we can really create the interventions, and the fewer lives that will be lost, and the less it will affect our economies and our societies.
And David, the one other thing regarding COVID that I've been asked over the past couple of days, because there was a major article in the last couple of days in the Wall Street Journal regarding the origins, reopening that question again, the origins of COVID. And this article is asserting increasing evidence. So these are the assertions from the article.
I know it well, Bill.
Increasing
well.
Evidence that this emerged from a lab. A whole lot of backstory to that. But I maintain, and I've said this on this podcast before, that at this point, it is not in, there's no good reason why this needs to be a public finding. Yes, the decision makers and the authorities need to have a pretty good idea and have discussions with the places where this may have leaked quietly behind closed doors, make it be well known that this should never happen again. But for this to be a major public battle over what's the right answer is not going to serve anyone well, including the American public. So that's my two cents. I have my feelings on what the origins of this were. but I there's no point in it's not going to do us any good. We have to look at what's going to be in the best interest of the country and the public moving forward. That's my two cents on this.
Okay.
Of course, well, Fred, I agree with you on that.
Fred, I know, agrees, and he's sitting in the center of one of the states where this has been a big headline issue. Look, I wasn't going to touch it. It's sort of the third rail right now. And look, the Wall Street Journal article, we highlighted it to our network. And let me, can I expand upon, both our conversations? It's, I don't want the audience to misinterpret anything that's said here. This is clearly an issue that's not going away. It is a highly politically charged and geopolitically charged issue. And what I've always heard from both of you is this is very much about whatever happened here, acquiring the lessons learned and making sure it doesn't happen again, whatever it is. And whether it's the sharing of information or experimentation in a lab that went awry, lack of precautions, et cetera. This is about going forward, making sure it doesn't happen again, and making sure if there is a global infectious threat, that there is cooperation between nations early and often, and the ability to get ahead of it as much as possible. Is that a fair summary, Bill, okay, Fred?
That's exactly right.
Okay. And more to come, and eventually information will come out. And I'll give the audience a little bit of a history lesson. There are still revelations from the Cuban Missile Crisis, which continue to surprise people. So it may take time. Appropriately so, Bill. Okay? So, okay. Anyway, more to come. Fred and Bill, again, thanks for sharing, being so generous with your time, and providing calm and common sense around important topics.
Thanks, David.
Thank you, David.
We'll be in touch sometime in the near future, as events dictate or information comes out. But obviously, if something happens sooner rather than later, we'll be back on the podcast. But again, many, many thanks, guys.
This is the RAIN Insights podcast, which is part of the RAIN Insights series, comprised of both virtual and real-world events, offering unique practical perspectives from RAIN's leading experts in risk management. To learn more, please visit us at rainnetwork.com. That's RANE network.com. Thank you for listening.